Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. My Olympian mission is to promote lifelong personal development, human empowerment, out-of-the-box thinking, creative self-expression, and a dedication of one's unique talents to community service. All of my labors in this lifetime celebrate the hero's journey in myth, legend, spirituality, popular culture, and in daily life. I firmly believe that the human spirit is essentially heroic and always seeking ways to express its innate nobility and greatness, and that a life fully lived, dedicated to actualizing the highest we can conceive, is the noblest expression of human existence. Tonight, I'm very proud to bring you Living Elenius Moss, which is part of our Light of Olympus series and chronicled in our Athenaeum. And Tony Merzwiski has as his guest, Kamwas. I'm really looking forward to this show. Greetings and welcome, Tony. How are you?
I'm fantastic, Hercules. How are you today?
I'm doing fantastic, too. I'm looking forward to hearing you and Kamwas speak, and I know I will learn from your conversation. That's always a good thing.
Okay, well, as you said, we're very privileged today to have a guest named Michael K. Waterman, who you call Kamwas, which is an abbreviation of his magical name. He grew up on Long Island. He is a hereditary witch from an ancient family, the Watermans, who are originally from the Isle of Man and moved to what became London sometime around 30 BCE. He began studying everything he could get his hands on ancient Egypt when he was about 8 years old, and now reads and writes hieroglyphs. He was initiated into the Circle of Bast Coven in 1972, which is in Long Island, and became a high priest for them in 1977. This coven was eclectic, drawing influences from Celtic, Norse, and Druid sources with a sprinkling of Egyptian influences. He is the high priest and founder of the Pet Neteru Egyptian Lodge Temples and School. He has taken on the magical name Setba Kamast Azar Heru Ra. I hope I got that right. He is one of the witch and pagan community elders for New York. He is an established psychic and medium working with multiple forms of divination. He uses a trance medium guide called Soren Seti. He's an expert on Egyptian ritual, magic, and Egyptology in general. In the mundane world, he's also a sculptor, a painter, and a well-known makeup artist. Michael, it's great to have you on the show. How are you today?
I'm wonderful. Thank you very much, Tony. And hello, Hercules. I'm sure you're out there somewhere still.
I'm here. I'll be sitting back listening. Just holler if you need me, anybody.
Cool.
We always need you, Hercules.
Absolutely. We always need Hercules. Before I start the interview, I wanted to give a little bit of background on Edgar Cayce for those who aren't familiar with him. Edgar Cayce lived from 1877 to 1945, and he was a famous American clairvoyant known to many as the Sleeping Prophet, who channeled information on healing, reincarnation, dreams, the afterlife, past life, nutrition, Atlantis, and future events. Cayce founded a non-profit organization, the Association for Research and Enlightenment, abbreviated to ARE, to store and facilitate the study of his channelings as well as run a hospital. Unfortunately, after a few years, the hospital was lost during the Great Depression. Cayce and his supporters were not deterred, and in 1931 founded the non-profit ARE, which is still in existence today. The headquarters are actually located in the same spot as the original Cayce Hospital. ARE provides body, mind, spirit resources for individuals to explore meditation, intuition, dream interpretation, prayer, holistic health, ancient mysteries, and philosophical concepts such as karma, reincarnation, and the meaning of life. Now, Michael, I understand that you have been registered with ARE since 1976. As a reliable astral projection expert and past life seer. Can you tell us about your registration?
That was done by Dr. Ted Bennett. We did some research, and he did some experiments with me with astral projection, very simple things, and they're actually in a few different books that Casey did and others. What they did was put objects and things in different places, in different rooms and such, and see if I, by projecting, could find them. And I did. They also worked with my guide, Soren Sethi, about past lives. One of them that Dr. Ted Bennett found was, I found, or I should say Soren Sethi found, a past life of his who was a World War I pilot who had died, and we found his grave in France and his name and, everything about his family, which was from England. And that was amazing to me. I was 18 years old, and Soren Sethi came to me, I think, because we were working, the group I work with, the coven I worked with, working on past lives and things, and I wanted to know about me. And I heard the voice saying, Michael, Michael. And I thought it was just one of my teachers outside playing games with me. And no, it turned out to be the spirit, this guide. His name is Soren Sethi. And he's been with me since 1976.
Well, just by way of background, for those who aren't familiar with Dr. Ted Bennett, PhD, he's a neuropsychologist in Jackson, Mississippi. He works for the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs as well as private. So also by way of background, a neuropsychologist is a psychologist who specializes in understanding the relationship between the physical brain and the behavior. The brain is complex, and disorders within the brain and nervous system can alter behavior and cognitive function. The role of a neuropsychologist is to understand how brain structures and systems relate to behavior and thinking. I'm really impressed that the ARE actually got someone of his caliber to evaluate.
He was working in a capacity as a parapsychologist also.
I didn't know that.
That was what was going on in the 1970s, great deal of, you know, more research into parapsychology. I also worked for a while with Hans Holzer, who I'm sure you're familiar with. He gave a lecture when I was in school at Nassau Community College. I was just there. I had read a lot of his books. I was fascinated, and he spoke, and I spoke to him afterwards. We became fast friends. He was talking about poltergeists. I grew up in a town called Uniondale, and we had a little boy that died in the house. His name was Frank. His mother had sold the house quickly, as fast as possible. She knew he died in the house, and she didn't want to tell my parents there might be a ghost there. And there was, and he was a mischievous little thing, and stole clothes, books. When we moved out, after we did a kind of a spiritual cleansing of the house, he was gone. But we found magazines, some of the clothes that were lost, change, and books and things that must have been taken from the 1950s that he'd stored there in the eaves. And we were shocked. My parents were shocked, and my brother and sister were surprised. My neighbors knew he died there. No one ever mentioned it except my next-door neighbor. He said the little boy fell out of a tree, went to bed upstairs in what was my brother's room, and passed in his sleep. He must have cracked a nerve in the neck or a bone in the neck. And, you know, as he laid down, it probably got worse, and he died.
Oh, that's so sad.
Well, he died in 1950, I guess 57 or 50, right around the year I was born, which was 58. And my parents bought the house in 1960, and we moved in just in the beginning of 61.
Wow.
It was kind of interesting. He was with us till 1977 or 78, and we moved out of the house in 1980.
So did you help the little boy transition into the light, as they
Yes, we did. We did an old ritual called the Necromancy of Intelligence, and we used Dittany of Crete and many other herbs to put the right energy into the room. Well, the funny thing was, it was light. I didn't see him, and I didn't see the light come except at the end of the ritual. And we heard a little boy's voice say, Grammy. His grandmother had come to take him into the next dimension. I thought that was beautiful.
That is beautiful. It's interesting that you use Dittany of Crete. In the book 777, it's aspected to Malkuth, which corresponds to the earth plane, and a lot of magicians will use it in manifestation work when they're trying to bring in an entity and have it manifest in the earth plane so that they can communicate with it.
I can tell you it works. It's a very strong energy. We also used myrrh, gum mastic, frankincense, elemental herbs like cloves, and some other Arabic herbs, I have to remember, and kulfi incense. But those things did the trick. My teacher used Aramaic. It was a language ritual in Aramaic. I understood only part of it. I hadn't studied that language yet. So I wasn't that familiar. I read and write hieroglyph, but that's got nothing to do with Aramaic. It's as old, but not, not a language I was familiar with to speak to, I should say.
Yeah, Aramaic was the language actually spoken by Jesus.
Yes,
so
yes.
While the Old Testament, the so-called Old Testament, was written in Hebrew, and they would speak Hebrew in the synagogues, the average person on the street spoke in Aramaic. So, that was the language that Jesus spoke. And there are still places where Aramaic is spoken, so it's quite a treat to hear a mass conducted in Aramaic because you get a feel for how Jesus would have spoken. I come from a Christian background, so that kind of thing still fascinates me.
I come from my mother's mother was a witch, and my father's father was. My mother's father was Church of England. My father's father, on occasion, would tell you he was from Church of England, but he was a plain old English witch, and my father's mother was a Polish Catholic. So I'm a mess, but I was raised in the circle. I am. I'm a mishmash. I could be the United Nations myself. I have so many backgrounds in me.
That's very cool.
But my
hereditary witch traditions coming together. Sorry.
Well, my father's father was an interesting man. He didn't speak much. He would sit and, watch his TV with his very old, typical London Englishman. He would watch his games, his ball games when he meant volleyball, his matches and his soccer matches. That's all he cared about. And he had a brew on the stove. Nobody was allowed to touch that. And on the other side of the stove was a pot, which he made his iced tea. And when he died, the pot that was the brew, which was something he used for magic, boiled over. And we still did it, and it just disintegrated, basically. So he just let that happen. He was my grandfather was an incredible wizard, I will say, and very little. He didn't teach me much. My mother's mother, though, did. She was the kind of lady, if you walked into her kitchen and you were bullshitting her, forgive my French, I should say Anglo-Saxon, she would look at her marigolds, and if her plants reacted, she knew you were full of it, and she'd say, get out. She knew. She was brilliant that way.
Just backtracking a little bit, I was wondering if you could give us a little bit more information about the ritual that you used to pass the young boy over. You mentioned the various incenses which you used. I was just wondering what else you used. Any of us who've seen TV shows, they all talk about helping people transition into the light. But it's fascinating to actually talk to someone who's actually done it.
There was writing done on, I'll say, in Theban script, which I know you're familiar with because you're hermetic. Theban script, and it was a magical circle drawn. There was an altar in the center, and there was a triangle outside of our circle, and that was where the boy was to be sent. His energy was drawn to that triangle. My teacher spoke the words. I was his assistant, basically, so I was putting the herbs and things on the brazier, on the coals, so that the room was filled with, it was heavy, smoky incense. And when the light hit it, it was beautiful. It was just and the light came from just outside, but I couldn't tell you where the source was because it was dark. It was late night, maybe 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. He had done that based upon the right hour for that particular ritual to be done.
Yeah.
And, he had a wand that he kept hidden. No one was to touch it but him. And we were dressed in white robes. We had a white, we wore white caps and white shoes. And everything, the altar cloth was also white. The brazier was in a big brass bowl, which I still have. And we used charcoal and sandalwood and cedar chips so that that also permeated the room, the fragrance of the sandalwood and the cedar.
Mm-hmm. Just interesting that you guys were inside a circle and you had a triangle outside the circle. It's very reminiscent of what's done in the Geisha, where you have the magician inside a magic circle and you have a triangle of manifestation to the northeast where the entity is summoned to manifest. So it's very reminiscent of that sort of setup.
And he when we worked together, he would speak to me in English, but he spoke to the little boy in kind of a, I want to say almost a Middle Eastern European language. I didn't at first understand what he was saying or speaking. The little boy didn't speak. The little boy spoke English only. But when he manifested, when his energy was there, then my teacher spoke English because the child spoke English.
Mm.
It was a very unusual ritual. At the end, both of us were exhausted. There were other spirits that were around the room. They were his family people that he saw. His father had smelled the incense. Well, it filled the whole house. It was thick. And after the ritual, the father came in, and he could feel the energies. We had erased the circle. We had, purified the area, cleaned out, and we had asked anything that was going to be there to politely leave and not come back unless summoned, which is how one does those things. And the room was the energy field that we had created, we deconstructed so that the normal physical plane would be in control of things, not the spiritual, and that we blocked things so that nobody could be harmed.
How does that
sit with you?
I think it's fascinating. I would have loved to have had a background like that. My background is boringly Catholic on both sides of the family. So everything I've learned, I've picked up from others outside the family.
But you have that in your past lives too. You're not new to this game. You've been around this physical plane in different forms for many, many centuries. That I know. And when I looked at you and I saw your images, I saw them. I knew I had seen you before. And I don't know if it was in this life or another, but I know we have a connection there.
You're not the first person to say that. I'm aware of at least a couple of past lives where I've been engaged in magical practice. But I'm supposed to be interviewing you, not the other way around.
Well, all right. So we're having a conversation. I shall now, as they say in New York, shut up and let you talk.
So were there any other highlights in the 4 years of testing that you did with Dr. Ted Bennett?
There was just little things. We worked on Edgar Cayce had cards for ESP. We used those. They did the astral projection work. Sarin Siti did the past life regressions and things. Every time we got done with that, somebody else from the company, the institute, what else can you tell me about me? It became like they were all asking him their past lives.
Yeah.
And, it was kind of, I began to understand Jane Roberts. It's exhausting. You bring this energy to a trance in your body, and then there's sort of a, I don't know how to explain it. It's like I walk out of one door, and Soren Cici would walk into the other door, and it's in my brain. And I didn't remember much till they would write, someone was recording what was happening. And it was very interesting.
So you said that when Soren Cici first manifested, you heard a voice. Do you actually see Soren Cici as well, or is it just
I know what he, well,
verbal communication?
Yes, I know what he looks like. I thought, years and years ago, I was at the Metropolitan Museum here in New York, and I saw a statue of a scribe. And it was after I had encountered Soren Sethi, and I knew it's what he looked like. It was a little heavyset man wearing Kohl eyeliner, clean-shaven, body-shaved, head-shaved. He was wearing, when I saw him manifest, he had a gold collar around his neck, just plain beaten gold. He wore four armbands, on the, two on the upper shoulder, you know, on the upper arm, and one on the lower part of the arm. He was barefoot. He had anklets also, and he carried a wah staff. That's a staff that has a almost an Anubis-like figure on top of it, and it bends down and goes to the floor. You'll see it in many of the ancient Egyptian statues as well as paintings. It is a typical staff that an Egyptian magician would have, as well as the pharaoh and all high priests and priestesses.
Yeah, well, the fact that you said that he was totally clean-shaven, including his eyebrows, suggests a priest, not just a scribe.
No, he was a high priest, but he said that he was the high priest of the library of Isis. He did not call her Isis. Isis is a Greek word. He calls her Aset.
Aset, of course.
Right.
Yes.
When I work with the Neteru, the gods and goddesses of Egypt, for those who don't know the word, I do not use their Greek names. I do not call her Isis. I call her Aset. Osiris is Hathor. Horus is Heru. I speak to them. I use the language of that they were, you know, worshipped in and are worshipped in to this day.
Anubis is Anpu.
Anupu.
Yeah.
And his twin brother, he is the black jackal. White jackal is Ampawath, yes.
Yes, yes. The openers of the ways.
Many of the different deities are also called that. Even Heteru, Athor, is also called opener of the ways. And Tehute, who is Thoth.
Yes. So you've got a magical name, Setna Kamet Azar Heru Ra.
Setna Kamet Azar Heru Ra.
Could you explain how you came to choose the magical name, or did the name choose
I
you?
I didn't choose the name,
what it
chose
means?
Me. Kamwes is one of the, I guess it's 18 or 19 sons of Ramesses III. He is not one of I'll call them the princes. He was a lesser from a lesser, probably a concubine or one of his mistresses. He was a priest of Amun. He went to the temple in Thebes, and that was the end of his rich relation as far as being royal. His two brothers, I'm sure you've heard of the harem conspiracy, his two older much older brothers tried to murder Ramesses III. In fact, they say that now that they did, one of them slit his throat. Kamwes followed Amun, and he was... They say he found, through astral projection, found a book, the Book of Ra, a beautiful Book of Ra, and that when he opened it, he vanished from this plane. Now, some people have said that was a nuclear pile of some sort, and the radiation disintegrated him. That's possible. They know that the Egyptians, as far as technology, were far more advanced than people think they are even today. I, through hypnosis and meditation, and again working with Soren Sethi, came to that name, that he was a past life of mine, Kamwes, and I even knew of his wife. When I went to the Brooklyn Museum, there's a stela of Kamwes, and I wanted so badly to touch it. It's behind glass in a huge cabinet, and I knew that that energy was something that I was familiar with in a past life.
Very cool. Very cool.
That's what's going to happen to you too, Tony. You will, if you walk into a room or a place that you've been to before, you'll know. And that's how past lives are. It's easy. When I go through the past life regression with someone, I don't see what's happening. They do. They're going to see that life through those ancient eyes or whoever it is. And they will see where they are, what they look like, what happened. And you'll see certain events and things. It's a very interesting, I'll call it a ritual in a way. It's really a form of hypnosis. I do not suggest to the person I'm working with anything who is a lady. Do you know how many Cleopatras, Napoleons, Shakespeare's I've encountered? People that, you know, they all, everybody's somebody famous.
Asylums are full of them.
One of my past lives named was Hank or Harry. He was a barber for Henry VIII. He's nobody famous. And when Henry VIII died, he hung himself. He wanted to stay with the king. And I have a weird problem about, like, ties and things around my neck. And I think that came from that past life.
Quite possibly. I actually find those sorts of past lives far more credible. Because, like you said, people tend to remember past lives as an Atlantean high priestess or a pharaoh or a king or something special. No one remembers being a cesspool cleaner or a swineherd. So being a barber is very credible. And I've had a couple of past lives like that where I've been a nobody, which makes me feel that those past lives are real. And, yes, I have had a deja vu experience. You know, my parents took me to Hungary when I was a teenager. So there was a particular castle we went into. But anyway, this is supposed to be about you, not about me.
In a way, but it is about me. I'm giving you what I know. I'm giving you the information that I work with every day and that, you know, I use to help people find peace in their lives.
Yes. But before we move into some of that work that you're doing, I wanted to talk about the Per-Neteru Egyptian Lodge Temple that you're the high priest of and you founded. I wanted to know what sort of magical work you do with the temples, and also what courses you offer.
We will work with the Egyptian calendar as well as, because I had to make a nod to it years ago, as well as the Wiccan or pagan calendars as well. There are crossovers as far as that goes. There's a basic book I use called Practical Egyptian Magic, which is by an author called Murray Hope. And it's a good primer,
Murray
good
Hope,
basic.
Yeah.
She's wonderful. And it is a way to learn a little introduction to Egyptian magic. And it shows you the levels of people that will be anointed or appointed for different parts of the rituals and what have you. In my group, everyone represents a certain deity. You'll have a Thaw priest or someone who is a Neptis, a high priestess or priestess, scribes and what have you. So I teach people how to use the hieroglyph in everyday things. I work with Ushabti, which is a little figure, and Ushabti means I will answer. And it's how to focus your – I use them as a focusing tool for people to hold on to and focus the energies, you know, to do what they want to do. If it's get better in business, find a home, you know, marriage, just feel better about themselves. The rituals we do celebrate the Neteru. They celebrate the energies. And I look at the Neteru as how I look at the universe, how I see, quote-unquote, God. I don't judge anyone else's religions at all. I don't think that that's fair to do that. To me, the divine spirit comes to everybody a different way. So I say that that's the way that should be looked at. The classes I offer are in basic ancient Egyptian ritual. I teach the symbols, the right colors to use, to work with the hieroglyph, so that you can put the energy where you need to put it. I do teach people how to make their own Ushabti. I teach them how to summon the energies of the deity so that they can use that in their own daily life. You know, and someone said, does everybody have a long Egyptian eyeliner on? No. And I don't tell people that, you know, we don't run around shaving heads and beards and whatever. I was bald for a long time and clean shaven. I have an autoimmune, I'll call it condition, and I can't shave my head anymore for a while till the whole thing is settled, as it were. It's getting better. My prescriptions are much less than they were. But in any case, to get back to that, for instance, Isis called me as a child. I knew, even though I was in a northern European ritual group, coven, they asked me who my mother goddess was. They were thinking Gaia or Freya or, you know, other Northern European gods and gods. And I said, Isis. They went, what? Isis? I said, Isis is my mother. And I knew it was from a Ptolemaic past life that I had, and that she had called me. I had a vision of her wrapping her gold wings around me, and I knew that was my mother. And I thought, well, that's... And when I saw the energy of Comwes, that's why I took the name, and that's why I know I'm part of the energy of the Nteru. And then more and more and more I studied and read and, you know, attended rituals from other groups that were Kemetic, which is ancient Egyptian ritual tradition. And I eventually was initiated and became... I worked also... You might have heard of Olivia Robertson. She was the Fellowship of Isis, which was in
Fellowship of Isis founder, yes.
Yes, yes.
I've got a number of friends involved
in
the Fellowship of Isis, yeah. And
She initiated me. She initiated me in 77. I was scared out of my mind. I'd never been to Ireland before. And there she was with her brother at the time. Very interesting lady. Very, very knowledgeable of many, many different pantheons. The one thing I wasn't wild about is a lot of those groups are goddess only. And to me, the balance in the world has to be goddess and God. I need, you know, you need yin and yang. And I teach that as well, that there should be a balance in the energy. Don't go all slide to one direction or to the other. I think we all need both.
I've been on the periphery of a couple of Fellowship of Isis groups here on the West Coast. And if you check out my Facebook page, you'll see that I documented a number of their rituals, the 40th anniversary, the 41st anniversary, where you had people from various Fellowship of Isis groups on the West Coast coming together. And while those women tend to be very female focused, most of the attendees tend to be women. They're not exclusively women. They will accept men. And one particular group kind of considered me to be almost an honorary member because I was always going along and taking photographs and participating in the rituals. It was a lot of fun. I thoroughly enjoyed those events. So, yeah, that's been my association with the Fellowship of Isis. I've never been formally initiated, but I feel like I was treated as like an honorary member. Anyway, just
Lady
as an
Olivia
aside,
considered me a high priest of Osiris and Isis. She knew that I felt very strongly toward Osiris, Osar, as well. And I do. Osiris and Horus and Ra are my father and family deities.
Very cool.
I'm sorry I interrupted you.
Yeah, one thing that I wanted to interject was you mentioned that you use Murray Hope's book on ancient Egyptian magic as one of the foundation texts of the Egyptian lodge temples. Murray Hope also wrote a couple of books about ancient Greek magic as well. She was a very, very prolific writer. And as we know, Herodotus was a great admirer of the ancient Egyptians. He believed that everything that the Greeks had came from the ancient Egyptians. So I feel very comfortable talking to you because the focus of this show is supposed to be Greek. So I don't mind giving an Egyptian focus for today.
Do you use? I'll call it the golden ass and the emerald tablet in your work.
Yes, I'm a great fan of Apuleius' text, The Golden Ass. Everyone uses the Emerald Tablet as a foundation text. It's one of the foundational texts of Hermeticism. It's not as early as we'd like to believe it is. It seems to be an Arabic text that goes back to, I believe, it's the 6th century. But everyone uses it as above, so below.
I learned something by reading the Emerald Tablet, too. Part of it is an instruction booklet to build a wand. There is an energy in there. If you read it, if you read between the lines, you'll see he has you building an energy wand, basically a copper tube with various things in it that are going to be used to project energy. And I've actually built things from that to show that it does work.
So what's attached to the copper tube?
I actually used a crystal. I can't afford an emerald the size that they wanted, but I had a green fluorite that worked. And I had various, I won't go into it, but metals and herbs and what have you in there in a copper tube. And it worked as a wand. They don't all have to be wood or, you know, crystal, you know.
In the 70s, I think, there was a Llewellyn book about wands. And the guy's name was Smith. I keep thinking it was Michael Smith.
Yes.
And he
yes.
channeled all this information from Atlantis. It was actually a fascinating text. He said he spoke to all these people who claimed to have had past lives in Atlantis. And he'd ask them questions about who they were in Atlantis, what they did, what their functions were, what tools they had and everything else. And he said most people, you know, just basically said, you need to accept what I'm telling you. And they wouldn't give him any sort of information beyond that. But if you would give him little tidbits. So what he claimed was he got these pieces of a jigsaw puzzle over 10 years. And then he wound up coming up with this wand, which he believed was an Atlantean wand. And it was basically a copper wand, and it had leather binding around it. On one side, it had a copper cap, which is difficult to find because all the caps you find in hardware stores tend to be made of brass. So people that have actually made these wands have gotten hold of a strip of copper, which they've bent and attached to the end of the wand, and it has a quartz crystal attached to the top, which is glued on. And the thing is, the impression that I got from the book was that the most powerful form of quartz was a double terminated quartz crystal. Because, you know, if you think about it, I still remember all the books that came out in the 70s about crystals. Most quartz crystals seem to form in clusters, but in order to use one of those crystals, you have to rip that crystal off so it becomes traumatized, whereas the double terminated quartz crystals are as they grew in the earth. So you just wash off all the dirt and you've got this beautiful double terminated quartz crystal. I don't believe in polishing them, that you can then put into the end of your wand. So that was supposed to have been an Atlantean wand. So he has other little projects as well. I found the whole concept fascinating, the idea of channeling information from Atlantean priests and priestesses and then doing a little bit of experimentation, putting out a book on it.
As I do with Egyptian magic, it's exactly the same. You know, and there's a school of thought that says the Egyptians were colonies of the Atlanteans. I don't know about that. I think the Egyptians did pretty well on their own, and they've been around since, I mean, we know pottery and such. That's, you know, more than 10,000 years old. So, we don't know. When do they say that Atlantis sank? What was the time?
There's actually a really interesting text on an Egyptian temple that maintains that the people of ancient Egypt came from an island that sank. And so there are some people who believe that the ancient Egyptians were actually Atlanteans. And interestingly, the ancient Egyptian culture and the Sumerian culture both took off at the same time, roughly 3400.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah. So,
and the Egyptians believe their gods and goddesses are from the star system in Sirius, and that their skin was gold. They were not human flesh colored. It's like in India, we know that Krishna did not want to be the color of any human beings. He's blue, right? So because he wanted no prejudice or hatred or nonsense as we have now anyway, because people worry about color. I always tease people jokingly when we talk about different races of people. I say the only reason that I would ever judge anybody's color is to match their foundation.
The easiest way to get your skin a blue color these days is by drinking a lot of colloidal silver. You wind up looking like a Smurf.
I don't think that's a good thing to be.
No, it's not. No, well, the thing is, colloidal silver is expensive, but you can manufacture it very cheaply at home. So you can pick up some silver, which is 99.999999% pure. You attach it to a transformer, put it into water, and you can generate your own colloidal silver. So people were making huge quantities of colloidal silver and ingesting large amounts of it. So if you Google it, you'll find that there's at least one person out there who's made his skin go a blue color. He looks just like a Smurf. He's probably healthier
than you
and I will ever be.
You know what, I do airbrush. That's a whole lot easier, right? Tony, I do airbrush. It's
and,
a whole
and
lot easier.
And that's permanent.
Yeah. I mean, really. Back in the 70s, it was so chic to be, you know, eating beta-carotene tablets till you turned bright orange, which a certain person we think did. But I think that, you know, we are meant to be the colors we are for the time being. This is the costume we're wearing in this lifetime. So, I mean, enjoy it. Whatever it is we are, if we're blue, red, green, purple, black, white, orange, that's who you are right now. That's what you chose. Use it. Do it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these days, people tattoo themselves all different colors, too. And that's okay, because that's what your life path said to do.
It's far more acceptable these days to tattoo yourself
What else can I give to you? What would you like me to... Sorry?
It was just the outcasts used to tattoo themselves back in the day. Now it's just totally acceptable. It's almost a rite of passage. Here on the West Coast, you can usually tell how old a girl is by looking at her lower back, because they seem to all get tattoos at the age of 18.
Tramp stamp,
It's almost a rite of passage. Yeah, it's almost a rite of passage. Yeah, wasn't like that when I was a kid.
Well, you know, in Egypt, they found mummies, many, many mummies of priestesses and priests that their arms and legs and parts of their chest and back were tattooed also with ritual symbols on them and spells.
Yeah.
And you wanted to get into
that,
too. That's another thing that I work with. So you were going to ask about services and such. My medium services, I work with divinations, various forms. I do use my guide when he's around. I do past life regression. I do what we call ghost busting, ghost investigations. I am a medium. I will work with the person's energy. I need their zodiac sign. That's their cue for me. I read tarot. Again, it's a prop. It's something that just gives me the energy, and I do that on the phone. My site is Phone a Wizard. I consider myself a wizard, so you phone me and ask me what you need. I teach how to use ritual and spells. I also bring or create spell kits for people. I do candle work, oil energies and things. And I teach people to do these things. One-on-one I prefer, because you can actually get more out of a class when you're working together, rather than doing 10 or 15 people at a time. And now this lovely COVID-19, God help us and goddess help us, has made it so that working on the phone or working through Zoom or, you know, FaceTime is the only way you can do it. Why sit around with, you know, four people or five people with the masks on when you can look face-to-face on a computer or a phone? It's interesting. It's changed the world, hasn't it?
It has.
Not necessarily in a bad way or a good way, but we've become more focused on where we're going, what we're doing, and I think we've become more careful, I hope anyway, with ourselves and the people around us. I think people have become finally more respectful of each other because of fear and COVID-19.
Well, the other thing is because people are going online to get information and experience yoga classes, meditation classes, and so on, then all of a sudden the world's become a lot smaller, because people who would normally run classes with local clients are now running classes with international clients.
Well, that's true. I mean, I have people I work with in Ireland, in Australia, in Egypt, out in California. I just had a student that I'm working with now that's in Auckland. I mean, that's literally around the world from me, right on the bottom of the world there. I've got people I read in Paris, in London, some people in India. so, you know, in a way, this has broadened my sphere of influence. I can help people. And to create lodges, we're doing things so that you can do that when we, you know, you've learned and you've got your degrees and your energies to build the lodge. And that's why the temples are growing, because we can't all get together, and because I can do this virtually, I can make things happen more than I could before. Usually it was just local people, you know. We have anywhere between 5 and 15 people in a group. A coven is 13. A temple can be, we don't have limits. And that's why I built a temple lodge, so that, you know, oh, well, you can't be in my group because we're over the limit. I don't like that. That wasn't true. It's not true in Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, you know, all the major religions. Why should it be true in magic? Why should you just have 13? So I didn't, as a young high priest, I didn't like that. The group I worked with, was, the original group, was aghast that I would be so, you know, rebellious that way and want to do things. But I saw things from the way of the Egyptians, not the European pagans. I love what they do, but I wanted to be able to help more people. And I didn't want to limit things. I didn't want to have, you can't be part of us. I don't like that. Limit, when you say no to people, you close the door. And I don't close doors, unless it's drafty.
Or you want another door to open. I'm being
That's
cheeky.
Right.
I'm being very cheeky. Okay,
well.
So you mentioned doing ghost busting. And the thing,
yes, I worked with Long Island Paranormal Investigators, LIPI. I was their spiritual advisor for a while, myself, and there was a young man named Peter Ferraro who now lives in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And we would go, there are many, many, many haunted houses in Long Island and in Queens and Brooklyn. And, you know, people were having things going on. There was a couple, I remember, in Ronkonkoma there, which is that way out in Long Island. And the woman couldn't keep any glasses or what have you in her kitchen cabinet. Things were flying all over the place. What had happened was it was the spirit of a biker who had died in the mid-80s, 1980s, not 1880s. He was friends or buddies with her grandfather, who had also passed. And the two spirits were in the house, and the other guy, the biker guy, didn't like her husband. So when he would walk into the kitchen, like, glasses would go flying, dishes and things. And by working with the energy, I understood this, and I put them at peace. And now she tells me, I speak to them at least twice a year, everything is fine. The other biker moved on with the grandfather. They moved on, and they don't bother them anymore.
So when you
and
say they
that
moved on,
delighted. Sorry.
So when you say they moved on, you mean they transitioned into the light?
They went back into the light
into
the
property?
Next dimension. Yes, yes.
Okay.
They're not manifesting in the physical plane or between planes again. They're not there anymore. There are other things that. A young girl was in a house in, I think it's in Levittown. She had died, like the child I grew up with, the ghost I grew up with. She had died in the house. She had pneumonia, and she passed in her sleep, and she didn't know she left. This is early on in the 90s, and I don't think we had the technology they do now. The group I work with didn't. And the little girl was upset because, again, there were people in this house that she wasn't familiar with, and she did bad things. She knocked things over. She would yell or scream, you know, and we were called in to kind of quiet her, and I'm able to do that using my own energies, and I also do rituals to kind of bless the house and clean the house. And that is something that I work with people when they ask me to. I'm also, as you said, a while, or you had mentioned to me before we did this, I do weddings. Lately, not so much because, again, of COVID-19, we have private little ceremonies. We can't do anything big. I will do what I call child blessings and namings. And I will also work on blessing the houses and such and helping people clean the house before they move out of it so that the energy that they have there moves on with them if it's something positive. And I remove any negative energy that will be in that house so to prepare it for the next people.
Most people don't really care. whereas it's always a good idea to bring the energy with you. In Slavic traditions, they want to bring the domovoy, which is the spirit of the house, over with them. So one technique which is used for that is to get a very long burning candle, let it burn for half its length, and visualize the energy of the house going into it. Then when you go to the next house, then light that candle again and visualize the energy being released. So you've taken the energy from the old house into the new house. Just a very simple technique that people can use. It's probably far simpler than anything that you'd be doing with your clients. I just thought I'd interject that. Sorry for hijacking.
Well, I do tell people to take a key from their old house. And I do use, I like a brown candle, like an earth color candle, which we will use too. And the key from the old house has the energy of the old house and good times and what have you, and does bring that into things with the family or, you know, who's ever renting or buying the house. So that's similar to what you're talking about, and I like that. It's a comfortable way to do things.
Sometimes the simple ways are the best.
Oh, yes.
People feel comfortable with them, and they're more likely to do them. You give them a complex spell to carry out, and they just rebel against it.
I don't do anything that's going to do anything complicated. And I don't need what people would call blood or sacrifice or all that garbage. And I'm not saying that in a negative way, but I don't want people hurting anything or anyone. I would rather have people use their own energy, positive energy, to make things, to accomplish what they do. If someone says to me, Michael, can you create a ritual or a spell to harm this person because they, you know, did something to me, I always say no. I will say to them, put that energy into Ma'at, who is the spirit in Egypt of justice. I never will work on revenge or, you know, hurting people or damage. I don't know the other side of the story also. This person did this to me. What did you do to them? And I don't know. And, you know, people don't tell you these things. There's always two sides. And I ask that the universe, that the mother, Ma'at, the goddess of truth and justice, I ask them to put that energy before her and let it go that way so that whatever the balance is, whatever the truth is, will come out.
Yeah.
And the energy will move one way or the other. It's better. It's much better. You know, I have
a
scribe box I work. Sorry?
I was just going to say that's a really...
Oh, I'm sorry, Tony. Go ahead. I'm talking too much.
No, I was just going to say it's a very neat way of doing things with a strong Egyptian flavor. But, you know, just calling on karma, which is a concept that virtually everyone's familiar with, does pretty well the same thing. Problem with karma is sometimes it takes a long time to come back. So the only thing I'd consider is doing a spell to accelerate karma.
Do you know about the spell using there's an herb, a flower. It's called Queen Anne's Lace. If you know anything about the Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens was one of us, as you know. Queen Anne's Lace ground and burned and put into the area near the person's home will give them what I call a teaching nightmare. It's an effective dream, basically. And you will see this also when you cast a spell. And they can actually see what they did wrong. And most of the time that I've had this ritual, I use this ritual, the offensive person will come over to the person that's cast the spell and say, gee, I didn't know I did it that way. I'm so sorry. And the energy, they, you know, make things work again. And that energy, you know, the energy is clear. And it's kind of an interesting thing. And I found out that Charles Dickens had come up with that idea by knowing about this kind of a spell and actually having done it to someone who was the prototype, shall we say, for Scrooge.
That's fascinating.
On that
and
note,
it goes back.
We're going to have to schedule a part two because this is a very fascinating.
Well, you know me, Hercules. I always talk too much.
No. You did awesome. If you can share your contact information, that would be awesome. And then we'll schedule a part two as soon as we can.
Sure. You can reach me at www.phoneawizard.com. You can get me on Facebook at Michael K. Waterman at facebook.com. You know, friend me, what have you. Or you can get me directly by my email, which is mkwaterman@icloud.com, not iClown, although my mother said that, iCloud.com. that works. Or you could get me on my home phone, my cell, which is 516-650-3691, and I promise to answer. Blessings to all.
And to you as well.
Uncle Jacques sent in.
Tony, how about you? Your contact information.
Probably the best way is through Facebook, either my personal page or my author page. And I also have a blog which I write for Pathos called Holistic Spirituality. I'm not brave enough to hand out a phone number. So just through those means works best for me.
Whatever works best is what we'll go with. I enjoyed today's discussion very much. I was thinking eventually introduce Serpentis Satori. He's written a few books on hermeticism, and he's popped in and out of my life. Every time I become active publicly again, he pops up. So his thoughts would be very welcome here too, and would lead to interesting conversations as well. And I see this path leading us to someplace great. So onwards.
Thank you so much for hosting the show, Hercules.
My
pleasure. Thank you, Michael. And thank you, Michael, for coming on. I really appreciate you giving up time and sharing.
Thank you, gentlemen. It was a pleasure. Hercules, as always, thank you. And Tony, it was great to speak with you. And I look forward to doing it again.
Awesome.
Indeed. Me too.
And thanks to everybody.
Okay, good night.
Good night. And thanks to everybody from home, whether you tuned in live as we speak or whether you're going to tune in later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And we're going to close with a couple of minutes we have left with Mighty Elohim by Linnell Griffin.
Sound the trumpet.